The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
I am not Dory Monson. My friend Dory is having surgery. Oh, no, he's not. He had surgery. He's recovering from knee replacement surgery. I can see people freaking out. Wait, another surgery? Nope. Dory just had one, and he's in a tremendous amount of pain. So he came to me as a friend and said, hey, would you do a couple weeks of the radio show? And I said, not only will I, it will be a joy. The show is legendary in Pacific Northwest, and it should be. So coming up, we're going to give you an exclusive. We're going to chat with a spokesperson for the Spokane School District. Brian Coddington's going to join us about what's been going on with this so-called game, Molest Me Mondays, which KXLY reported. So Brian will come on and give the district point of view of that. Now, as Dory would say, because I'm a huge listener to the show, with that as mere prelude, let's get into The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Top story.
Ah, we'll do top story. Let's do that. Top story locally, I think, is probably the Supreme Court in Olympia has decided that the way laws are supposed to be written doesn't matter if you're Sound Transit, because the way laws are supposed to be written, or bills, rather, produced and presented to the legislature, is when you talk about a funding mechanism, you are not to hide the funding mechanism. Legislators are not supposed to have to go look for the funding mechanism. It is to be clearly and plainly in front of the legislature. That's not what Sound Transit did. It was on purpose. They made a decision to hide the formula they were using to take money from you for your car tabs. They wanted to hide it because they didn't want the legislature to know they were using a scheme that the legislature had negated twice. They had canceled it twice, said twice, we're not going to use this formula. So the Supreme Court of Washington State, which I call the Seattle Supreme Court because they serve the interests of Seattle almost exclusively, said, no, we don't care. We want what we want when we want it. And what we want is to serve the powerful interests that back the Sound Transit cabal. Those powerful interests are big developers, big unions, and big, powerful Democrats. So Pete Rogoff and the thuggery that he employs at Sound Transit wins another one. You lose one. Your last hope in this is a $30 car tabs that a King County judge took on the side of Iman. Mostly. There's a couple of questions I know, but it is constitutional. $30 car tabs, that coming from a King County judge. So in terms of cars and in terms of what we're going to drive, there is a bill in Olympia because they're busy, man. They're busy looking out for you. We told you in the first hour of The Big Lead that one of the items they're taking on is making sure it's no longer a felony to knowingly pass on HIV to someone without telling them. It's only going to be a misdemeanor. Thank goodness. The nation, the state, everybody's been clamoring for that change. They're also looking at banning cars that are not electric. So that to sell a gas-powered or diesel-powered car, or for all I know, a hydrogen-powered car, that would be illegal in Washington State. And they're doing this clearly to save the environment. Because as Greta Thunberg has said, and she is the authority on global warming, and, oh, pardon me, on climate change, no, pardon me, the climate disaster. Did said, all right. No, sorry. Climate catastrophe. In other words, the weather. Greta Thunberg has told us we only have, what was it, 6 minutes? It's 6 years? 6 years. Okay, 6 years until we're all dead. That we got to get away from fossil fuels. So they're making this effort to outlaw cars that burn fossil fuels, except they're not. They're not making that effort. They're making an effort to advantage a new industry. Because people like Tom Steyer, who made a bunch of money in fossil fuels, said, okay, so that's fished out. We're not going to have 1,000% returns anymore, 1,200% returns on our money. Let's go out and found another industry. And let's do it the same old way. Let's do it by buying out our competition. No, not by purchasing their companies, but by going to Washington, D.C., and getting our companies and our industries the protection of being mobbed up. That's what that means. When I talk about being mobbed up in D.C., it means you can buy congressmen and senators. You're mobbed up. Here's why I say that. requiring the sales of only electric cars in Washington state doesn't stop fossil fuels. This is from fee.org, F-E-E.org. It's a free market website that I recommend, fee.org. The carbon dioxide in cars doesn't just come out of a tailpipe. Okay. Electric cars emit CO2 in a couple of ways. Number one, during their production and during their charging. Okay, so the production of the batteries requires some materials, lithium, cobalt, and manganese. So where do those come from? They buy them at the store, right? They pick them off trees, right? They go pick cobalt off a tree. They don't. They mine it. They mine it out of the ground. The mining is not done with electric engines. They don't have enough power for that. That's done with fossil fuels. This means that for instance, a Tesla battery, a 75 kilowatt battery in a Tesla, for every single battery, you're talking about 23,000 to 32,000 pounds of carbon emission to make the batteries for the electric cars. Secondly, there's this. The recharging, the fueling up of these cars. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, 63% of total electricity generated in the United States is created using unicorns. Sorry, I read that wrong. No, it's created using fossil fuels. 63% is created using fossil fuels. Now, I can hear you. Like, wait, this is Washington State. We're all about hydropower. So that's all well and good, Herman. That's all well and good, but we use hydropower. Well, hydropower. Funny thing about that. Wazoo, Washington State University, was one of the colleges, universities that studied this with teams of researchers from Canada, Holland, China, and Brazil. What they found out was man-made dams, hydropower, we've been underestimating the carbon dioxide emissions and carbon dioxide equivalent emissions by 25%. So let's put this into perspective and how this works. When you dam up a river to create a reservoir, you kill the plants that were already there. So you have a stagnant lake, kills off the existing ecosystem. That means that bacteria then enters and it eats the decomposing plants and it generates one, carbon dioxide, two, methane, a greenhouse gas that is 86 times more potent than CO2. So, to review, Jay Inslee and the Democrats want to pay off the campaign donors like Tom Steyer and the electric energy people, mob-like, thug-like, to ban you from buying a gas car in Washington state under the guise that they're going to reduce carbon emissions, when the reality is they're not going to be reducing any such carbon emission. That's not what's going to happen. They're going to, in fact, be reliant upon things that release methane and carbon at higher rates than gas cars. But you get to act like you're doing something so, so, so important for the rest of the country, right? That's the local stuff. But we don't just live locally. We also live in a great big nation as we continue with the Big Lead.
The Big Lead, top national.
All right, top national. Clearly, the media would like us to have the top national story to be all about President Trump and all about him choosing to fire people who had worked at the NSC, people who had been appointed by Barack Obama, people who've been leaking things to the media, etc. They'd like us to talk about Vindman and his firing and forget that this happens all the time and forget that, in fact, Vindman, according to the sources I have, was not that particularly well-liked in the armed forces, at least when he was serving with the troops. But I think that might be a bigger top story nationally. It's probably this, but you're not probably going to hear this in the national media. What if you came to the United States and you couldn't speak English? Would you consider that a disability? And if you did, should you get disability assistance because you cannot speak the language of the country you've chosen, in which you've chosen to live or chosen to emigrate to? Well, this is actually being considered in the House of Representatives, that if you come to America, you don't speak the language, that alone qualifies you for disability payments.
They're one of the cuts that my so-called friends from the left are saying is that if you come into this country and can't speak English, then you're disabled. Have you heard that?
It is one of the qualifying factors right now within the disability insurance program that we're trying to reform.
How dumb is that? If you can't come into this country and speak English, you're entitled to all the benefits of this country because you can't speak the American, you can't speak English. The American people are on to it and they get it. Tax cut.
Just think of this. Like, yeah, I think I probably shouldn't move to France because I'm too stupid to learn how to speak French. My brain doesn't work that way. I can speak a few words of Spanish. Now, granted, I have a job. I've got some economic advantages. And grant this, realize this, that the United States is the biggest home for people who are displaced. We are 5% of the population of the world. We have taken in 20% of the world's displaced peoples. We provide the bulk of foreign aid, both official, that is government money, and we provide the bulk of foreign aid unofficially, which is philanthropic endeavors, charity from you. So we have nothing to be ashamed about in terms of our willingness to let people in. But at some point or another, you start to take this great life raft, which is the United States. And I'm proud of that. Look, members of my family fled Europe because of what was going on there. They weren't safe. So I'm very proud of the fact that we are a home for folks who need it. But at a point, the life raft becomes flooded, right? Financially flooded. And we can't just hand out money because you don't speak the English language. Now, speaking of handing out money, Elizabeth Warren told a story that there's no win in this story. Elizabeth Warren, running for president, having lost now in Iowa, having lost in New Hampshire, she's not going to be president. And what Americans have always sensed about Liz Warren is that she's faking things. She's a liar. She is making up her entire history. It's not just the being never been a Native American, never claimed to be a Native American until she was seeking a professorship in law at Harvard. All of a sudden, she started talking about being a Native American. Had never mentioned it before then. Everybody knows she's not. She did the disastrous DNA test, found out that she is less Native American than the average American. So she's not Native American, but she told a story about a broke college student.
I tell you, there are so many people who are in this fight for all the right reasons. You know me, did the speech and then afterwards did a selfie line and we were there for over an hour. And people are coming through and they're saying thank you and they're giving hugs and talking about what's important to them. A young woman came up by herself. And she said, I'm a broke college student with a lot of student loan debt. And she said, I checked and I have $6 in the bank. So I just gave $3 to keep you in this fight. That's what we got to do. We got to stay in this fight with people who are counting on us. This isn't about fighting other Democrats. This is about fighting for the America we believe in.
Number one, when she says, you know me, I was taking selfies with people. Did that come across as, yeah, she seems like a person who really likes hanging out with little people. Secondly, the win is what? You took half the money that a starving college student had. She has $6 to her name. You took $3 when you were a multimillionaire. No win. Secondly, it didn't happen. There are people, even people on the left, they're saying, what are you doing? No one gave you half the money. How did she get to the event? If you have $6 to your name, how did you get to the event? So Stephen Colbert, speaking of Washington, D.C., put out a little video mocking the founding fathers of the United States for creating what he thinks is a rigged system. Because Stephen Colbert He's a lot smarter than Thomas Jefferson. He's a lot smarter than George Washington and Ben Franklin. So put out a little video to prove it.
Donald.
George Washington? You were an American political leader, statesman, and founding father.
I know you're reading from Wikipedia.
I guess you're angry that I'm trying to deny millions of Democrats their right to vote.
On the contrary, we founded this country with the intention of limiting voter turnout to no more than could fit in a single barn. I was elevated to the presidency by an electorate consisting of 24 landowners and one alleged libidinous deviant named Ben Franklin.
Our Ben Franklin is named Alan Dershowitz.
But we concealed this imbalance of power by weaving into our Constitution a great tapestry of rules, tricking the common man into believing all was fair. That tapestry is shredded by Sir McConnell's bill.
But if I don't sign that bill, I'll lose.
Sign that bill and your victory will be a hollow one. Don't sign and you may risk defeat. Unless you try winning the American way by searching the Constitution for ways to let as few non-white people vote as possible. The choice is yours.
So, just so we're all clear, the black vote turnout, African-American turnout, has gone up. It went up in Georgia. It went precipitously in Georgia, where we were told there was massive vote suppression. There was record turnout. Secondly, speaking of the Electoral College, from the level of an elite, and Stephen Colbert is a New York City elite, means this. If you do away with the Electoral College, there is legitimately, in reality, never again a United States of America. There is New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas. That's it. Everyone else has no vote. So New York City and Los Angeles and San Francisco will be making decisions about farmlands and forest lands. And at that point, there is no United States. The founders saw that there were going to be populous areas and less populous areas. What do you think they chose to do? Well, let's just let the cities run things? No, they decided to distribute power. Stephen Colbert is not quite as clever as he thinks he is. Coming up on the Dory Monson Show, Brian Coddington is a spokesperson for the Spokane School District. What's going on with this Molest Me Mondays thing with apparently a sexual assault style game that the district apparently knew about but didn't stop? That next on the Dory Monson Show, Todd Herman filling in. Joining us now from Spokane, Brian Coddington is a spokesperson for Spokane Public Schools. Brian, welcome to the Dory Monson Show. Todd Herman filling in. I sure appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. I let me predicate this by saying I am a product of the Spokane School Districts. I had a very good experience there overall. My mom was a career teacher there. Some of my very best friends continue to teach in the district. So certainly don't want to get into the game of school bashing or teacher bashing. We're obviously really concerned about this report KXLY published saying that there's been a long-term game that appears to be kind of a sexual assault game called Molest Me Mondays that KXLY contends and some parents contend has been going on at Shaw Middle School for quite a while, and that it was known by school officials. So committed to fairness as we are, I want to get you on and talk about this.
Well, thanks for having me. So let me start off by saying right away that we don't condone this type of activity. We take it very, very seriously, and the staff there has taken it seriously and reacted and responded to any reported behavior or behavior that they have witnessed. This behavior typically happens away from staff use, so they largely rely on reporting of from students of this type of behavior. At this point, they believe there's been one report of this type of behavior this year. So the memo that was referenced in the story was in relation to a staff memo that was pushed out to staff members to make them aware that this had occurred and to help them be vigilant in watching for this type of behavior. That incident was dealt with swiftly, and discipline was handed out appropriately for that student. The parents of both involved students were contacted and made aware, and the first choice is always to partner with the parents in terms of any type of discipline and activity. But it's not something that we condone. It's something that the staff is very mindful of and pays close attention to. They've taken steps in terms of educating staff members about what to look for and how to help students be comfortable reporting that to a trusted adult, whether it's a teacher or a counselor or principal or admin or other trusted adult, to make sure that behavior is dealt with quickly. There's been two attempts at education of the students, and those typically come after major breaks, so after the summer break and after the winter break. That education has occurred with all the students, and it's just an opportunity to really enhance and remind students of the appropriateness of behavior and what they should do if they witness or experience anything that makes them uncomfortable.
All right, so Brian Coddington is with us, spokesperson for the Spokane Public Schools. And Brian, the KXLY article refers to a leaked memo, and leaked dated November 2019. And the story contends that parents were not informed that this Molest Me Monday activity had been going on, which people who've been affected by this are comparing it to sexual assault. Were parents not informed?
So the memo was a staff memo that was sent from the administrators to the full staff, so they were aware of the situation. And those types of decisions about informing parents are made at the building levels, and typically when there's a single incident that happens, they make a decision to involve just the immediate families. When there's repeated activity that goes on over a period of time, that's when you start to make those decisions about informing the rest of the families. In this case, they had experienced one report of this activity this school year, so since late August through current. And so the decision was made to involve just the family members of the immediate incident.
Okay, so parents weren't warned. I mean, the immediate parents were talked to. A mother talked to KXLY, said that no one had told the parents until she did. In hindsight, given that we're understanding this to have been pretty widespread, but you're saying it was isolated? In hindsight, does the district feel they did the right thing here and maybe should have, or maybe should have informed all the parents?
So we did go ahead and make a communication to all the families this week in response to the coverage to make sure that they had the full story and heard it straight from us. These are difficult situations. You want to make sure that you are keeping families informed, but also don't want to overwhelm them with information. And when you have an incident, as I said, one reported incident, you want to treat that accordingly and appropriately. And we certainly understand that there are families out there that felt like we should have done something different, and we have taken that feedback and we'll use that as we move forward to learn and grow from the situation.
Okay. And how many students were affected? How many students, I think it was mostly young women who described these assaults. Exactly how many students were touched in these ways?
We're aware of one report this school year, and so one of the things that we're doing and staff has been doing throughout the school year is to make sure that students are comfortable reporting this type of behavior. Just because there's only been one report doesn't necessarily mean there's only been one incident, but they're acting on anything that they see or that it's reported to them. So the work that they're doing right now is to make sure that students, one, know what the appropriate boundaries are, and then two, if they see something or experience something that's uncomfortable to them, to make sure that they tell that trusted adult, whether that's a teacher or a counselor or a principal or someone else in their life, so that they can help them get the help that they need in terms of investigation and accountability down the road.
Okay, so I want to make really clear that I'm listening very closely to what you're saying. Brian Coddington is with us, spokesperson for Spokane Public Schools. You said you received one report this year. Did you receive reports last year of these behaviors?
I'm not aware of any reports last year. What I've been told is there was one report this year that's happened, and so they've dealt with that report this year, and again have educated the staff, and that'll continue. And then the most importantly, the education of the students will continue. And they've taken some steps to increase presences in hallways and make sure that during passing periods, there's extra sets of eyes and ears out there and making sure students are comfortable reporting if they feel uncomfortable.
Okay, last question for you, Brian. I really appreciate you coming on. You came on at short notice. This story is kind of going viral. Very thankful you came on at short notice to give the school's point of view on this. You said that there was one report this year. Are you and are the staff aware of any other students who have been touched inappropriately in relation to Molest Me Monday? Is any staff aware of any students who've been touched but did not report?
Not that I'm aware of. Not this school year, no.
Not this school year.
Oh, I don't have information on the previous school year, so I don't want to make a comment on the previous school years. But what I'm aware of this school year is they're aware of one.
Okay, fair enough. I really appreciate you coming on. You do an important work, and like I said, that's my background. This, my entire family's in education just about. So Brian Coddington, Spokane Public Schools, keep educating the kids. We sure appreciate you coming on, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us on Cairo Radio.
All right, thanks for having me. Have a good day.
All right, from that, something that I get asked to do a lot of listeners want to hear more about our family's journey through mental health. We used to call it an adolescent mental health thing. It wasn't. It was a family thing, continues to be. There's things I can't say, but there are some things I can share with you that I think every parent, or people thinking of being parents, should know. Hard lessons we've learned. Share those with you next on the Dory Monson Show. It's Totterman filling in on Cairo Radio. Todd Herman filling in for Dory Monson on Cairo Radio. Dory continues to recover from his knee replacement surgery. He's in a lot of pain. So continue to offer prayers for Dory. He's a prayerful man. He has a great relationship with God that I know he's sort of shared with you guys. And I'll let you know, he is someone who prays for his friends. So I know he would appreciate that he be comforted. Folks have asked me from time to time to be more detailed about the mental health journey our family went on that we had referred to at one point as an adolescent mental health journey. It's not. It's a mental health journey of a family. It was last night again that a listener asked me, hey, could you provide more detail? I really can't, because I share with you what I have permission to share, because my primary, my primary responsibility in life is to my daughter. But I can tell you some things that we learned that I think all parents can really benefit from hearing and from understanding. One of the first things that we learned, and this is the toughest of all lessons we learned, is that if you have a kid who's suffering, in all likelihood, your family is broken. You may not realize it's broken. You may think things are fine, and you're probably great people. One of the things we learned in working with families whose kids have suffered either mental illness or they've had severe trauma is that most of the parents are actually overly good. They are overly involved. They are not, for the large part, not neglectful parents. The other thing we've learned is that the parents we met have a lot of money, because I'll tell you what, adolescent mental health care is ungodly expensive, and insurance isn't great at covering it. So what we learned is, if you have a kid who's suffering, there's something that is broken in the family, and that if there's a broken kid, there's a broken family. And that doesn't mean that you are to blame. It means that your style of parenting is being ineffective with your kid. So if you're seeing patterns from your kid, patterns of isolation or patterns of, God forbid, they're cutting or they're doing these things, one of the first things we learned is treating the child as what they call the designated patient. That's a completely ineffective behavior, because you're now inserting a shame cycle. And the shame cycle works like this. Kids who are depressed or anxious, they think, I have nothing to be depressed about. My parents, I've got a beautiful home. My parents care for me. And that makes them more depressed, because then they feel shame. And it becomes a self-repeating cycle. If you're recognizing that the family has some challenges and you're openly communicating and you're hearing feelings, those things don't fester the same way. So we had to learn that lesson. The other lesson we had to learn was ineffective patterns. And we were trained to not look at things as, oh, that's a bad thing, or that's a bad way to parent. But there are some ineffective patterns. One of the most common patterns that we uncovered, or that we came about to see when we, got info in support groups with other parents, etc., is the pattern of parents fixing their kids' emotions. Now, hear me on this, because it's so tempting as a parent. Your child is sad, so you try to cheer them up. And by trying to cheer them up, maybe you're trying to change their emotions. So your kid is really sad and really crying. So you're talking to them, you're hugging them, you're touching their hands, etc. And you're saying things like, well, tomorrow will be, and hey, do you remember when? And you're trying to bring them some good memories. You're trying to distract, is basically what you're trying to do. What we learned is that is wildly ineffective, and it leads to this feeling that kids get that my feelings are not important. Okay, with some kids, it leads to that. The better thing that we've been taught is to elicit the feelings, or to solicit the feelings. it seems banal and silly, but it works. And that is, I can see that you're feeling really sad. I see that you're really upset, right? Are you feeling shame? Tell me about how you feel. And even if you think the kid is wrong to feel it, let's say your child is really angry that they didn't get invited to this party when, let's say, they don't even know the kids there, right? They're not even part of that group. You don't have to agree with the content, but the feelings are valid. Yeah, you can say, I can see you're really hurt. I think that might hurt me as well. Wow, that's a lot to carry, right? And you're listening. Don't play a game. Don't pretend to validate the feelings. Get into it. Attune to your kid. Get there and feel to the degree that you can what they feel in that moment. And then share with them your hope that they will find a way to deal with it. And what you're sending to them, what you're transmitting to them is your feelings are important. I hear your feelings. And you are capable of dealing with it. What we learned through this process of therapy is that when kids don't get their feelings recognized, they will find a way, damn it, to be heard. They will find a technique where you have to know, you can no longer avoid the fact that they're hurt, right? So sometimes people think that kids cut themselves to hurt. They actually cut themselves to say, I am hurt. Is one of the things that we've learned. Last thing is this, that what I just said about attune, you know, feel your kids' feelings, make every attempt to really empathize with the feelings they're having. That's great in those moments, but parents also have to be able to step back into a role that we were taught as a curious observer, right? Particularly with older kids. You cannot prevent every harm from them, and frankly, you shouldn't try. You cannot prevent them from doing risky things. They're adolescents, and frankly, you shouldn't try, because if they skip the risk-taking portion of their life, they actually don't grow into fully mature adults. So the curious observer role is your kid is, let's say, not getting their homework done. You know there's going to be consequences coming. It is not your job for a 15-year-old kid to get up and say, you're getting the homework done, or X. Now, if they continue to fail, they continue to refuse to do the homework, that's a separate issue. But on isolated incidences where you see a pain coming, observe. They're the one who's going to come home with a bad grade. They're the one who's going to have to come home embarrassed. And then what do? You tune and you validate and you say, I hope you will find a way to work to make this better. None of this means that you don't problem solve, but what it does mean is that the feelings for kids are so primary. Then don't email me, don't tweet me about raising snowflakes. That's not what it is. What it is raising kids who understand their feelings are heard, so they don't have to take dramatic steps to say, I'm hurt. Some of the things we've learned on this journey. It's Todd Herman filling in for Dori Monson on Cairo Radio. Hey, Tom and Curly are next. They're in the afternoons now. Thanks for having me. You can keep in touch with me at Todd E. Herman on Twitter. Tom and Curly up next.
I want to thank you because you have been so incredible in this issue. And I want to thank you. I know it's not appropriate to thank you. You're a great journalist and you're a great reporter. I don't care what they pay you. They made a good deal.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.